The House Committee on Judiciary. We're going to work off the agenda this afternoon. Going to first start, however, by giving just a couple of moments to Counsel Joseph to bring us up to speed on a couple of things.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, you'll see two documents in front of you. The first is a memorandum for myself to members of the committee. It lists the website where you can find Dr. Ed Latessa's information that he used in his presentation, as well as a number of other National Institute of Criminology curriculum materials. They're downloadable in various formats. Please contact me if you need assistance in downloading those materials or otherwise accessing them. The second piece of information is a graph that was provided to me by the Department of Corrections. It shows that the request of the committee a while back was a question as to what percentage of the Oregon population was incarcerated at any given time. That graph shows the Oregon population growing over time, as well as the line below it will show the percentage of people who are incarcerated. And then underneath that, you'll see a smaller graph that actually lists the hard numbers. I have additional materials that I've got, probably about 8 different pages of graphs with other types of information about the Department of Corrections population. If you're interested in those materials, I can have them emailed to you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Joseph. We're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2047, and I'm going to ask Mr. Taylor to outline the bill before we move to the
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first two bills on your agenda, this and the next one, both relate to the Vienna Convention on Consular Affairs. Back in about 40 years ago, the United States entered into the Vienna Convention on Consular Affairs. What this means is that a foreign national who's in the United States or a United States citizen that's overseas, if they are stopped and detained, has a right under this convention to contact their consular official. Last session, the legislature received in about April or May letters from the Mexican consulate over this issue, the fact that rights were not being enforced in Oregon, for that matter, and throughout the United States. And frankly, we were unaware that there was a Vienna Convention or there was a right to notify anyone under it. And you received a letter, Mr. Chair, as did Senator John Minnis, and this issue was put over to the interim agenda. And the year last September, at its first meeting of the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee, we heard from the Mexican consulate plus the consular officials for about 4 or 5 other nations. And after that meeting, you asked me to put some legislation together, which I did. At the same time, the Department of Justice started up its meetings it had had with the Mexican consulate again on this issue. And through that process has developed some other ideas. But you have before you 2047, which addresses the issues of someone being stopped by a police officer. It also addresses two other issues. One is education for police officers as to this issue, because we found out in September that many law enforcement officers, like a lot of us, were not aware of it. And then also it addresses the issue of notification in the mental health situation. And then you have the next bill before you, which deals with the issue, that's 2091, which deals with the issue of dependency matters. That, for example, if a child is up here from a foreign country with their parents and there are allegations that the child is being abused and the child is brought before our courts, that there's an obligation that parental rights may be terminated, that the consular officials for that child's nation be notified of the proceedings. That also holds true for probate matters under similar circumstances. So, Chair, members of the committee, that's why the two bills are here. Now, a lot of this is already the law of the lands. It's required in the United States to do much of this anyways. So there will be debate about that, but in many regards, particularly in dependency areas and others, it's filling in some of the details.
Okay, thank you, Counsel. I will inform the members of the committee who were not members of the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee that we had several hearings and got updates on the progress on this issue, and I'm sure many of you have been contacted by various parties about their concerns regarding the bill, and today's purpose is to simply have a hearing and get our questions answered to the best we can on the subject matter. So I'm going to ask Pete Shepard if he would come forward first. Pete's the Deputy Attorney General, and we appreciate him being here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I am the Deputy Attorney General. Thank you for scheduling this hearing and for inviting our testimony. I'm providing to the committee some written testimony that describes the concerns that the Department of Justice has with Section 1 of the bill. But in as much as there are several folks who are here to testify about those elements of the bill, let me just brief the members of the committee who were not part of the interim activities on the activities of the Attorney General's effort, Attorney General's work group around this issue, by way of background, and also by way of telling the committee that we really have made significant progress on this issue in Oregon over the past 3 years. About the last 3 years, the Attorney General has hosted a working group that includes the Mexican consulate, representatives of the Mexican consulate, the Mexican consul general, and representatives from time to time of other consular offices here in Oregon. In addition, the working group includes state and local law enforcement officers, including very significantly representatives of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, who, as you know, among their members are responsible for managing Oregon's jails. Let me tell you about three activities, three accomplishments that this work group has achieved, all by way of generally raising the level of compliance in Oregon with this treaty, which, as you know, is the law of the land, meaning it has the same force and effect as a federal statute would have. And the treaty does require, under certain circumstances, that foreign nationals detained here are required to be notified of certain rights that they have under this treaty, very significantly the right to contact their consul, who then would provide assistance of various forms to that person who has been detained. So with that overall goal, the working group, as I indicated, I think can mark three achievements to its credit. First of all, House Bill 2091, though in its current form, and as I understand it in the amendments that you may have before you this afternoon, hasn't quite captured it. Nevertheless, that will be a consensus proposal of the working group. That's the bill that pertains to dependency proceedings, and the treaty, various elements of the treaty have implications in that arena. And all of the members of the working group have reached a consensus that ultimately will be presented to this committee and recommended to you for your approval. Second, very significantly, the working group reached an agreement on specific language that Oregon law enforcement officials could use when they are obliged to give the required notification. And that's significant because the treaty itself doesn't provide the exact language. And so we've managed to reach agreement not only on the English version, but also on translation into the multiple languages that Oregon law enforcement officials might have to deal with. So that's the second thing we've done. And then the third thing, I think, is that we have helped raise this the level of awareness amongst Oregon law enforcement officials to the point where now this is an item, the treaty is an item that's covered in the training that's provided to law enforcement officials at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training Academy. What the work group has not reached agreement on is Section 1 of House Bill 2047. And let me see if I can frame the issue here a little bit for the committee by way of explanation of the Department of Justice's position. The treaty itself requires notification to be given to a person detained or arrested, quote, without delay, close quote. and it provides no definition. The treaty itself does not contain a definition of that phrase. I've outlined in the materials that I provided to you the State Department's guidance on the question of how it expects an American national detained in a foreign nation to be treated. And as you'll see from that, the State Department's expectation is not that notification shall be given any time there is any form of detention. Rather, the standard is relatively more flexible and aimed functionally at the question that really underlies the purpose of the treaty, and that is connecting the foreign national to consular assistance for dealing with the machinery of government. And so the working group could not come to a consensus as to exactly when in the spectrum of interaction between a law enforcement agent and a foreign national detained in this nation, exactly when that notification should occur. The Department of Justice does not support House Bill 2047 because it locks into Oregon law one conclusion to that dispute, that is, at the time of any detention. That would be the requirement under Oregon law. And you might say, well, the bill doesn't permit any consequence to be attached to a violation of Section 1. And I think you'll hear from some folks that that is itself a reason to object to Section 1. I would have another reason to be concerned about Section 1, and that is, although it excludes liability for the individual officer, it does not on its face exclude liability for the officer's employer. And so just on the plain text of Section 1, it seems to me that an argument could be constructed that it gives rise to potentially to civil liability for the officer's employer. So because the bill, Section 1 of the bill, locks into Oregon law an interpretation that the United States State Department would not insist upon with respect to an American national detained in another country, and for the reason that it may give rise to civil liability under circumstances that the treaty would not support itself, the department does not support Section 1 of 2047.
Are there questions for Mr. Shepherd?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I may have a question for you, Pete, as I'm trying to sort of think through this. So it's only Section 1 that the Department of Justice objects to. If the section included the language which you pointed out was the language from the State Department that talked about deliberate delay and notification should occur as soon as reasonably possible under the circumstances, for example, if that language were substituted for Section 1 of the bill, would that make the difference for the department?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think it would, and here's the concern. If all that we do is write into Oregon law a standard that we imagine to be identical to the standard imposed under the treaty, then it doesn't seem to me we've added anything to the law. The treaty is already the law of the land. It has the same effect as if Congress had passed a statute that contained all of those requirements. And so the question, Mr. Chair, if this committee were to adopt a standard that word for word tracked what we envision the requirements of federal law to be, the question someone looking at this 5 years from now or 10 years from now might well ask is, what did this legislature aim to do? What change in law did you intend to enact? And it seems to me if the answer to that is you didn't intend to make any change, then it's unnecessary. If you intend to make some change, then I think it's risky because you may be creating liability where none exists under the treaty. So simply tracking the federal language would not resolve the concerns for us, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes, Representative Shetterly.
Any question? Then Pete, I guess if that is the case, if I could follow that through, do we need 2047 at all? I mean, and what's the purpose of it then? If this really, and not arguing with you, but if federal law, by virtue of the treaty, mandates whatever it is that it mandates, is this an issue for, and I know we've talked about this in the interim before, but I'll just ask you again today, is this an issue for legislation or education?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, my answer to that would be it's an issue for a combination of education and some portions of the bill speak to the possibility of requiring that, and that isn't a piece of the bill that the department objects to. And some it is desirable to take some legislative action to implement the treaty in some other respects, and that is the subject of the other bill, and that is a consensus proposal. So we do think there's a proper role for the legislature to play in helping Oregon do its part to support this legislation. Ultimately, or support this treaty, rather. Ultimately, the answer to the question of what without delay means should be a matter for government-to-government action and interpretation as it would be for any other treaty. And so we don't think this is an area in which the state ought to act.
If I could follow up then on Representative Shetterly's question, Pete, and I got your point about the next bill, 2091, but on 2047, those sections that deal with other than Section 1, I mean, is it your position that those are unnecessary?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as to the educational piece, it's may not be necessary because it's part, as I understand it, part of what the instructional curriculum. But it doesn't carry the same risk that Section 1 does. The other portions of the bill seem to be, from the department standpoint, they might be useful, and so. We don't object to the other portions of the bill. I think there are probably others, Mr. Chair, who can speak more directly to some of those other provisions. But for example, the requirement of notification in civil commitments, there is the treaty does apply in the civil arena as well as in the criminal arena, and so notification is required there. Timing is a little harder to sort out in the civil commitment arena because there are a variety of ways in which a person comes into that system. And so it might be useful to look at that as to whether we can provide some guidance on various ways people enter that that system. So I think there may be utility in the other sections, Section 1 that is draws our concern.
Okay. Further questions? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
I just want to develop the record. You had another objection to the liability, the immunity, not being extended to the public employer. Was that, I'm just trying to see where you're coming from on that. Is that because the Oregon Tort Claims Act only recognizes the employer as a proper party, and this would be a loophole for liability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, if this were styled as a tort claim, and I'm not sure it would be, but if it were styled as a tort claim, we would move to substitute the state of Oregon for the individual named in the action. But on the face of this statute, of the bill, Section 1, it precludes civil liability in an action brought against an individual. But the text of Section 1 does not preclude civil liability in an action brought against the individual's employer.
Okay. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wouldn't that same lack of relief from civil liability then be extended in sections 5 and sections 4 with regards to the civil commitment and the mental health and the physicians and nurses and people that are looking after these folks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think you could make the same objection to the exact language of those provisions, yes. We're concerned, again, we approach this mostly in terms of our interactions with the law enforcement entities, and that's where Section 1 raises the concern for us.
Anything further? Okay, thank you, Pete. Next, John Powell, Sheriff Burright, and Captain
Montanaro
and Ed Stollard. Welcome. Who's going to start? John?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. What we have before you today is a panel of Sheriff Burright and the Captain Montanaro and Lieutenant Stollard to give you at least an opinion on the controversial provisions that have already been pointed out in the bill from the sheriff's perspective. We've asked Sheriff Burright to lead off with that presentation.
Mr. Chairman, representatives of the committee, I'm Dave Burright. I'm the Linn County Sheriff. In the interest of time, I don't think that we'll need to expand here very long. You've already heard from the Attorney General's office, and you will be hearing from Dale Penn, representing the DA's Association. I want to point out, for the committee's sake, that we are willing to work with you in any way necessary on this particular bill, though we do have a number of concerns about it. You know, we do recognize that the treaty applies regardless of Oregon law, so as Mr. Shepard has pointed out, it does give us pause for thought here. We are also very much concerned about the definition of detain as is found in the statute. What does that really mean? There is not necessarily a direct correlation between federal law and Oregon law. Even within Oregon law, I'm not sure that the definition of detain would be the same as perhaps what you're after here. I think that it opens up many, many questions and would give us problems down the road. Also would like to make sure that the committee is aware that the Sheriff's Association has already made some very large strides in complying with this. We've been a party to the discussions over the last 3 years, both in the working group that Pete Shepard mentioned, but also this has been an ongoing discussion in the Governor's Public Safety Policy Council, to which I have been a member. And the Sheriff's Association, through its jail managers, have a series of 400-some different standards dealing with correctional facilities in the state. And we've adopted the standards that comply with the treaty as it relates to someone who's been incarcerated. And so that piece is already taken care of. I have to admit one other thing, too, I'd not even thought of until I heard Pete's testimony, and that's the potential liability for the employer. And speaking as the person whose name is the one that always appears on that notice of tort action, that one does give me a little bit of grief, and I would certainly hope that some way or another we can take care of that issue should this bill continue. Would you like to talk for a moment about the jail standard?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name's Captain Chris Montanaro, Klamath County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Burright spoke briefly regarding the Oregon jail standards. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association several years ago adopted the standards, which have implemented best correctional practices throughout the Oregon jails. One of those particular standards deals particularly with the notification of people that we suspect may be foreign nationals who are coming into our facilities for the purposes of being lodged or booked and released. To my knowledge, the jails within Oregon comply and routinely notify the consular's office of the respective national that person is in custody and they've been informed of their rights. And I personally have dealt quite a bit with this subject matter in the consular's office in Portland. So I know it's something that we're already complying with as associations and as local correctional facilities.
Lieutenant Stollard, did you have anything to add?
Just a couple of minor points, Mr. Chair, gentlemen of the committee. I'm Lieutenant Ed Stollard. I'm the patrol commander for Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. As previously stated, the term detains in any way has a different meaning in Oregon. For example, as been pointed out, a traffic stop for a minor traffic violation could be considered under this bill to be a detention, in which case the officer would be required to notify the person of the right to contact an official from their consulate. Then, along with that, the bill does not provide what happens next. There there's no provision that allows, that says that the officer has to allow that contact to occur. And if it does the officer, how long do they have to wait for a person to be allowed to contact their consul for a minor traffic violation? You could even argue that somebody who is detained as a witness in a criminal investigation under this bill could be required to advise that person before they could continue with their investigation. That person has a right to contact an official from their consulate. I just believe that this opens up a lot of problems for patrol officers in the state of Oregon in attempting to abide by the provisions of this.
Any further, Mr. Powell?
Mr. Chairman, I'm responsible for that piece of paper that's been handed around with the yellow highlight, which is from a State Department website. I took that from late last night. I wasn't able to photocopy it until just before the hearing, so it doesn't have my name on it. I apologize for that. But it does indicate the issue that has been brought up about the traffic stop. The State Department does not consider that kind of detention qualifying under detention under the treaty. However, as Lieutenant Stollard just indicated, it would appear that it would be under Oregon law any detention. And so that's an extreme concern that we have, and we just provided that for that purpose. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for the panel from the Sheriff's Association? I've got two, Representative Ackerman, Representative Krummel.
Go ahead.
Representative Ackerman.
All right. Just to the panel as it is, are you familiar with any cases in Oregon where the failure to advise a foreign national of his right to communicate with the consular office has been raised in a Miranda hearing, that is, regarding the voluntariness of the confession or admission, or any attempt to use this as part of the exclusionary rule?
Chairman Williams, Representative Ackerman, but just at least among us here, we're not aware of any such problem.
I was curious because the bill provides that the failure to provide the information does not in itself constitute grounds for exclusion of evidence, and it seems to me we may be building in a statutory factor for the exclusion of evidence that's based upon a foreign treaty, and I'm having a little bit of a problem trying to put that concept together, but we'll need to know if you have any experience with that, and I'll ask that of some of the other witnesses to come forth. Thank you.
Anything else, Representative Crowell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on Representative Ackerman's question about the Miranda rights. So logistically, is there an actual reading, if you will, of the rights? You know, under Miranda, you're supposed to pull your card out and read the rights to them, to the detainee. Is there an actual reading, or is it just sort of an advising that they may have the right to contact the consulate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, within the Klamath County Jail, in both the pre-book area and the booking department, we have very large signs printed in English and Spanish that advise individuals of their rights to notify their consul. And through the booking process, there's a series of questions that we ask, and one of which is, are they, U.S. citizen, naturalized citizen, and so forth. At that point, we specifically advise them again, verbally, of their rights. So I can speak specifically to the portions that pertain to the jail. Lieutenant Stollard, I'm not sure if you can speak about the patrol issues or Sheriff.
Chairman Williams, Representative Crummel, there is not currently any advice that I'm aware of from the patrol side that deals with this issue. Usually because we know that is taken care of in the jail when there's an actual custody. If there's no custody, then it's our position there's no need to advise them of the right to contact their consulate. So an officer makes an arrest, the person goes to the jail upon their booking at the county jail, is when they receive that advice.
And please correct me if I'm wrong. Under Miranda, isn't the and I recognize it's two separate things, but I'm just trying to clarify in my own mind. Under Miranda, the rights have to be read at the time of the arrest, or is it at the time of booking?
Chairman Williams, represent Kremel. You're right. There are two separate things, and it's hard to compare apples and oranges, I think, here. With Miranda, you have to have three components: police, custodial, and interrogation. So, in theory, if I'm going to arrest someone and I'm not going to ask them any questions, I really don't even have to advise them of their rights. But it's a customary rule. I don't know of any police officer that doesn't. And oftentimes it's far before the point where you reach a point where you're going to arrest them. If we're talking with them on the street, working on an investigation, generally speaking, even though we don't even have to at that time because they're not in custody, most police officers will do it anyway. That's always been my case. We don't necessarily even have to read from a prepared card. As long as you're able to articulate the key components of the Miranda warning. Oftentimes we will read from one, however, and sign it, and that way we've got proof that it was done correctly.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, Dale Penn from Marion County.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. I'm representing the District Attorneys Association on House Bill 2047. We oppose Section 1 and Section 3. I think that all of the testimony that Mr. Shepard has given, it's very similar to my handout that I'm providing. And however, we have the same difficulties with Section 3, and they are the two criminal law portions of this bill. Section 1 relates to detention. Section 3 relates to arrest. And all of the same problems come up with arrest because in Oregon, there are huge numbers of arrests that are done just as a traffic citation. That misdemeanor arrests are done by citation. Many C felonies now are done by citation. They aren't there isn't the idea of the custodial arrest where people are cuffed and taken down to the jail. Huge numbers of cases are processed by a citation at the scene. And so all of the problems about the detention section one come up in the same context when you talk about arrest under Section 3. I provided a little bit of that information, which has been cited by Mr. Shepard and by the Sheriff's Association, about the Department of State's interpretation of this treaty, and that it is not designed to apply to the brief detention scenarios, such as traffic stops, such as situations where you're writing a citation, and this person is not being held incommunicado. I think that's really what this treaty is all about, and that's why we have set up the work group, Department of Justice and law enforcement. We began the work group to be proactive on the Vienna Convention, which has led to this adoption of statewide policy for all jails and the use of forms for this translated into 10 different languages that have been provided to every jail in the state. Kevin Campbell is here, who's representing the Chiefs of Police Association. I don't believe he plans on testifying. His position, the Chief's position, is the same as ours and the Sheriff's, that we oppose this bill with Sections 1 and Section 3. I might give a couple of examples. I've stated in here that detention, as you've already heard, and arrest, I would argue, is a different scenario than what those terms meant under the federal system back in the 1960s. And that is the problem with developing a statute today. because it's 2003, it's a state of Oregon, and you have to bring forward what those terms mean under Oregon law today. And clearly, detention encompasses a traffic stop under Oregon criminal law. And that creates this problem. This is a federal treaty. The Department of State is very clear that it is not supposed to apply in those scenarios, and it creates a huge practical problem. A police officer on the street now is supposed to carry a form in multiple foreign languages and then make a decision, how do I determine whether or not this person is a foreign national unless they tell me that to my face? Now, in the work group, we talked about that problem in the jail context, and clearly no one wants law enforcement to ask a person, are you a foreign national or are you a United States citizen? No one wants the police officer to ask that question. And so what is the officer on the street supposed to do? A very difficult, practical problem. One of the cases that is being litigated in the world court here, and you have to understand that this really has come forward and is being utilized in the criminal justice system to fight against the use of the death penalty by the United States in a worldwide level, and the litigation that's gone forward in the international courts have all been death penalty cases. But one of the examples is two individuals in the United States, I believe in the Detroit area, that had dual citizenship. They were Germans. And there was never any discussion. No one in the criminal justice system ever realized that they were not United States citizens. And it just creates the practical problem. How do you know this? I don't even think both defendants knew that they were German citizens because they came to the United States or they were born in the United States and they didn't realize they had dual citizenship. It's just a very difficult issue that's being brought into the Oregon criminal justice system. There was a question earlier by Representative Ackerman if this treaty has been raised. Yes, it has. Court of Appeals has said that it does not create individual liberties, but then that case was appealed to Supreme Court. We thought that it would be answered in Oregon by the Oregon Supreme Court. However, in the last 2 months, the court said that the issue was not raised appropriately at the trial court level, and so they did not answer the question. There are other cases in the system that will answer the question whether or not the Oregon Constitution provides some unique interpretation of this treaty that would impact suppression of statements or suppression of evidence in Oregon. That is not going to be changed by a statute. We just believe that by adopting Section 1 and Section 3 of this statute, you will cloud the issue. And it definitely will be argued that you are creating some individual right by this, whether it relates to civil liability of suing employers versus individuals, whether it relates to the fact that violation of this statute plus something else creates suppression, even though the language here says violation of this statute by itself does not create suppression, you will empower the argument. And it will take us 6, 7, 8, 10 years and hundreds of thousands of dollars to answer that question. So that is why we are opposed to those two sections. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Penn, does the treaty use the words custody or arrest, or does it simply limit the discussion to detain in the treaty document itself? And I ask this because I don't have the treaty in front of me.
Mr. Chair, I know Mr. Taylor attempted to use the exact language, but It's been quite a while ago since I looked at the exact language. I know his detention language is drawn straight from the treaty. I believe arrest is in some place in the treaty itself. My point being that arrest in Oregon, because of the citation process, has changed dramatically.
And that's my question. And I notice Representative Ackerman is pointing out testimony that was provided to us by Pete Shepard, where he says Section 36 of the treaty provides that a foreign national detained or arrested, and I don't know whether, I guess, not having the actual treaty language before me, I wanted to know if it used the word arrested, or if we're sort of assuming the word arrested in the discussion about detained. My recollection was from months ago when we had this hearing that it didn't actually use the word arrested, it simply used the word detained. Which I think would mean that if it doesn't use the word arrested, it would seem difficult for me to believe that at least the violation issues that you're indicating, where we, you know, basically write a ticket that constitutes an arrest, mm-hmm. would be viewed as equivalent to detention under the language of the treaty. But that's an issue that we could look at further if we wanted to, and we will obviously look at the actual language mm-hmm. of the treaty. Mm-hmm. Your other points, I certainly understand where you're making them, but it was that one that I wasn't sure about, because my recollection mm-hmm. was it just focused on the word detained.
Yes.
Maybe for that very purpose, because there are a lot of process things you can do to somebody mm-hmm. In other countries as well as our own that don't constitute detention necessarily, and mm-hmm. I think that's what the notice was intended to do. I saw Representative Barker had his hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's what I was going to say. In some of the foreign countries, what they may determine detention, where they just take somebody and lock them up for a long time without any of the rights that we enjoy here, may be what this treaty is trying to address.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I don't disagree with the representative on that point. I think that it's important, however, that, you know, and I want to commend law enforcement, the governor's office, and everybody else who's been working on this issue over the past few years, because to the extent we've got international obligations about what we ought to be telling foreign nationals when we do take them either into custody or detain them, we ought to be doing it. And we ought not to just assume that. I know that if I'm in another country and I am detained, I'm going to want pretty quickly someone to, you know, remind me of my opportunity to seek my counselor, my consular office. And I think that is something that we ought to take real serious. Mr. Taylor?
Chair, members of the committee, when I talked with Virginia Vanderbilt on drafting this document, we had also been meeting with Pete Shepard's group. And what we did attempt to do in that group was to see if we could find common ground on a white line test, and we couldn't. And when I talked to Virginia, we use the word detained because that's what's in the treaty. We're well aware of the fact that it's not an exact term. But nonetheless, it's what was in the treaty, and since we couldn't come up with anything else, that's the word we used.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could add one other comment about
sure.
that. I don't want to take away from this discussion that in any way a foreign national has less constitutional rights than someone else in the criminal justice system. The same tests apply: Miranda, voluntariness, and those issues will be litigated. The issue before us is, will there be additional rights that will be individual rights enforced by the criminal justice system? And that is the one that at this particular time in history is very difficult. Because if this does create individual rights, questioning foreign nationals will be, in the state of Oregon, a very difficult crime investigative tool. And I would seriously doubt how much questioning could take place if there are individual rights of foreign nationals here different than citizens. And at this time in history, I just don't think this is the thing that we should be doing in the state of Oregon. If it truly is a unique constitutional right, the Oregon Supreme Court will tell us that. We will deal with that. But legislation gives the danger of giving signals to others or empowering arguments that can be made trying to bring forward that type of position. That's why we oppose it.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Ingrid Swenson. And Andrea Meyer.
I suspect will tell us they like sections 1 and 3 of the bill, but they hate everything else.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and Andrea Meyer from the ACLU. I guess the first thing I do when I read this convention is to think, if I were in a foreign country, or if any of us were, and supposing you were in an automobile accident and you didn't speak the language well and you thought you had been wronged and you were injured, but somehow the police, after talking to the driver in a language you didn't, the other vehicle in a language you didn't understand, decided to handcuff you and take you into custody. I think it's under those circumstances that you'd want to know what your rights were in this circumstance, and the best person for you to confer with is probably your consular official. They could tell you whether you have a right to have an attorney with you or not, whether declining to speak to the authorities means you will wait in custody for 6 months until you can appear in court. There's all kinds of things that a person would legitimately need to know in order to protect themselves if they didn't understand the law and the culture of the place where they were staying. And I think it's clear that the United States, as well as other countries, recognize that their own citizens' protection involves recognizing and respecting the protection of other residents of other countries who are in our country. I did appreciate the Attorney General's effort to bring everybody together, and I think there were some genuine successes that arose out of that. I'm pleased that we were able to agree on appropriate language for informing people of this right. I'm pleased that the jailers at booking will be uniformly considering whether people are entitled to consular notification and doing that in those appropriate cases. I wish that we could come to some agreement about when it's appropriate, particularly for law enforcement officers on the street, the patrol officers, to notify people of their rights under the convention. There is an obligation to do that, and that question is unanswered for them. And so they can read the convention, and they can look at what other jurisdictions are doing, but I don't think it's helpful for them to say, well, you know, you figure it out. We're not going to give you any guidance in Oregon law. California, New York, several other jurisdictions have, well, at least I'm aware of three other jurisdictions which have enacted in state law the requirements as they understand them of the Vienna Convention. And the convention certainly contemplates that this law will be enforced locally, and that some decisions will be made about implementation under the laws of the jurisdiction where an arrest or detention occurs. It would be desirable to have a sort of bright line where people could say, okay, I need to now notify this person of their rights. And also to have a good understanding that until you get to that bright line, it's not one of the things that you have to worry about. Law enforcement officers have a lot of things to think about when they're taking somebody into custody, making decisions about what's going to happen. We don't need to add to that burden by saying, oh, here's something else to keep in the back of your mind in case you decide at some point that this person may be a foreign national. And for that reason, we recommended to the group that the Miranda warning time be the appropriate time for providing information under the convention. And it makes sense from a number of points of view. The information we have all received from the State Department is that they don't read a traffic stop as a point at which convention rights become critical. And that's because the person who is given the ticket is free to go, can confer with the consular official on their own if they choose to do that, or with whomever they choose to confer before taking some further action on a citation or a traffic ticket. However, when an officer decides that it is necessary under Oregon law or appropriate under Oregon law to give someone their Miranda rights, that's because they have decided to either question them or arrest them and has determined that that person at that point is legally in custody under Oregon law. And under the convention, I think the interests are similar because there is enough at stake at that point. You may be going to jail. you may be being held for questioning long before you go to jail. And that's why advice at booking on its own is not enough. Somebody could be held for 8 or 10 hours and questioned without ever going to a jail. So advising somebody at the time of booking doesn't cure that problem. And I think the convention clearly affects people who are detained for more than brief periods of time, even though they're not in a custodial facility. So we certainly agree with Gail and the law enforcement folks that this standard doesn't really create that bright line for them, and we would certainly like to see that happen. We would also be disappointed in a measure which basically contained no remedy of any kind for a violation of what would amount to an Oregon statute. It's tantamount to saying, well, we're serious about this, but we really aren't serious enough about it to expect that you would experience any kind of sanction for disregarding, even if it were intentional, your obligations under this treaty. Just a couple of other comments. I think it is worthwhile to put something into Oregon law. I think it would be beneficial. And people are struggling to abide by the the federal law, but it's clear that it's a lot of people aren't even aware of that obligation. Training is ongoing, but from the testimony you heard today, people are basically satisfied that if it occurs at booking, they don't intend to offer that information in some jurisdictions before that time. And to me, that's clearly inadequate, clearly a violation of the treaty. So I think there is a benefit not only to this discussion and thank you, Bill, broadening the information base that people have, but putting it in Oregon statute so that it's clear that this is as much a part of the law as everything else that appears in Oregon statute.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ingrid, I think what we've heard is that by virtue of the treaty, this obligation is imposed by federal law. And I guess so my question then is, irrespective of House Bill 2047 and whether the state does or does not provide remedies under state law, are there remedies under federal law, either, I'm sure not explicit in the treaty, but, do you have habeas corpus? Do you have something like federal Miranda? Certainly not now, but, is there another prospect for development of that kind of federal standard? And would it be appropriate for the states to wait for that uniform federal standard to be developed, if one is to be developed, for the vindication of any of rights under this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I'm certainly not the most knowledgeable person about that issue, and there are people in this room who know a lot more about it than I do. But so far as I am aware, at least I'm aware of a Ninth Circuit case which sort of left open the door to remedies under the federal law. It basically said we do not decide whether a violation of Article 36 may be redressable by common judicial remedies such as damages or equitable relief. But they didn't decide that. And then I think the Second Circuit is sort of split on this issue. I'm not sure that there are remedies available under federal law, or at least that all of those where people have attempted to find a remedy have been unsuccessful, but I don't know. But I suppose more importantly, this treaty is nearly 40 years old, and it's only in recent times that people have attempted to implement it appropriately. And it seems to me that the state of Oregon would, benefit all of its citizens and residents by taking a very clear position and saying this is the law and we want our folks to be not disregarding it.
Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there was a reason that subsection 2 of section 1 was put in. And that is because of the cases I read, and it's been about 6 months since I have, they've usually found the right under the treaty to exist with the nation that signed the treaty, not the citizens. So when you see suits in this area, it's usually the country of Mexico, the country of Germany, whatever.
which leaves open the issue of whether an individual can sue and whether an individual has rights. One of the concerns you have in Oregon when you create a statutory right, our courts have found that you also create third-party liability. So, for example, if you require that a party, someone to be detained if they're intoxicated and you release them and they walk outside the police station and get hit by a car, their heirs have a right to sue. So to at least limit the likelihood of creating something that probably does not, at least at this stage of judicial interpretation, does not exist for the individual, was the reason for putting that section in.
Mr. Chair, could I just comment briefly? But Article 36 does refer to the right of the individual indirectly by saying that a person is to be informed without delay of his rights under this treaty. And the International Court of Justice in the LeGrand case and other cases has recognized that this is a personal right which may be enforced by individuals.
Further discussion? Ms. Meyer.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU. I would first also like to echo Ingrid's comments and our appreciation to both Attorney General Hardy Myers and Pete Shepard in the work group, because there was progress made, and we do appreciate the hard work that went into getting folks to sit down and work through those things. But the ACLU of Oregon does oppose House Bill 2047 as currently drafted because it fails to provide any remedy for violations of a foreign national's right to have consular notification. Under Article 36 of the Vienna Convention, effective in 1969 in this country, it protects a foreign national's rights to consular notification and access if a foreign national is, quote, arrested or committed to prison or custody pending trial or is detained in any other manner, unquote. Article 36 applies to both criminal and civil and immigration detentions, and it requires local authorities must notify a detained foreign national without delay of his or her right to seek consular assistance, must notify a detained foreign national's consulate of the arrest without delay if the foreign national so requests, and must permit the consular officials to communicate with and assist the detained foreign national. The right to consular notification and access is designed to help safeguard the due process rights of people who have been detained in a foreign country. Consular officials can provide an invaluable service by helping their nationals, including U.S. nationals, better understand the complex legal structures of another country. The U.S. government has long emphasized the critical nature of the right to consular notification and access when its own citizens are detained. The U.S. State Department has stated that the obligation in Article 36 are of the highest order and should not be dealt with lightly. In 1975, when the Syrian officials failed to notify the U.S. consul in Damascus about the detention of two American citizens, the State Department wrote the Syrian government the following: the right of governments through their consular officials to be informed promptly of the detention of their nationals in foreign states and to be allowed prompt access to those nationals is well established in the practice of civilized nationals. Detained foreign nationals are inevitably distressed by the prospect of securing and preserving their rights in a legal system with whose institutions and rules they are not familiar. The consul, while fully complying with the law of the detaining state, is able to assist those nationals in securing and preserving their rights, often by helping them obtain local counsel. The consul's presence may also help assuage the distress of detained nationals. Some of the services that the U.S. consuls are required to provide U.S. citizens detained abroad include providing defense counsel, advising on adequate defense counsel, providing counsel with adequate information about the defendant, including discovery background and education and cultural differences, obtaining foreign documents, assisting in the transporting of witnesses, and assisting in the mutual understanding necessary for the defendant and the defense lawyer. Failure to notify a foreign national of his or her consular rights can constitute, quote, structural error, unquote, in a criminal case, because such failure can constitute the entire conduct of a trial from beginning to end, as well as the framework within the trial process. As the Fourth Circuit recognized in 1998, the United States citizens are scattered around the world as missionaries, Peace Corps volunteers, doctors, teachers, students, as travelers for business and for pleasure. Their freedom and safety are seriously endangered if state officials fail to honor the Vienna Convention and other nations follow their example. The ACLU of Oregon believes that the proper interpretation of Article 36 means that the affording of this right, a personal and individual right to the detained person, must be at the time of the arrest, and in any case before the accused makes any statement of confession to the police or judicial authorities. To fail to provide the advice to the detained person prior to questioning and statements would be to render the convention's consular notification provision useless. We suggest Miranda as a point in time in the criminal justice process to be a point consistent with the spirit of Article 36, and a point about which law enforcement officers are already trained to recognize and use. We oppose House Bill 2047 as currently drafted because it fails to provide any remedy if there is a violation of the Article 36. A right without an ability to enforce that right, or without consequences for the violation of that right, is indeed an empty right. Thank you.
Further questions for Ms. Meyer?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Ms. Meyer, would you anticipate that the warning would be given to only those persons arrested or detained who, at the time of the Miranda warning, appeared to the officer to be foreign nationals? Or would you anticipate it would be given as a matter of road in all cases, just on the chance that it might be foreign nationals?
Chair Williams, Representative McPherson, I mean, obviously one of the concerns is we don't want, and I know law enforcement doesn't want to be put in the position of so-called of racial profiling, of someone looking like they're foreign, and we know that foreign nationals look like every one of us. So I believe the best way to address that would be the expectation that become part of the regular type of Mirandize that they give. If you are a foreign national, I believe that's how the wording is currently in the form that we've all agreed to. It doesn't presume, but it notifies them if they are, they're alerted to this.
Any further questions, Representative Barker?
And then what's the next step that somebody says, yeah, I'm a foreign national, so I don't want to, you have to allow me to call somebody. How do you know they are? How are we going to deal with all of that? How are the people on the street going to deal with all of that? The patrolmen out on the street.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, may I?
Please.
It's a problem under current law. It's not being created by this statute or this effort to draft a statute. It is an obligation under the treaty at this point for law enforcement officers to be making those decisions and deciding when and under what circumstances they are obligated to notify the consular officials. And the treaty doesn't envision that you do an investigation on that issue. It appears to envision, I'm looking at State Department interpretations, envision that if you had reasonable belief based on the circumstances that a person might be a foreign national, if they gave you a foreign residence, if their English appeared to be not strong, their English language skills weren't particularly strong, something like that to put you on notice, then it is law. It is the law that under those circumstances you would be required to notify the person of their right to have their consular officials notified. And they could assert that right and say, well, I'm a citizen of Guatemala, and I would like you to assist me in contacting my consular official. And you would be obligated to do that if you had a reasonable belief that that person were foreign national.
But I'm hearing discussion different that is this as to when you have to first notify, and that seems to be a discrepancy, if that's the right word, between what the law enforcement people and the district attorney said and what you're saying. And I certainly want people notified, that foreign nationals to be notified, unlike some other countries in the south. I mean, I don't know, a number of people have been arrested in Mexico. I've asked them about that. None of them are advised to do anything but pay lots of money real quick or else. But I'm having a little disconnect on exactly how we're going to do this is all.
and Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, I think by extending it out to Miranda, you get beyond the points that you heard of concern to Dale Penn and to the sheriffs, which is in a short detention time frame, traffic citation situation. I think we agree that there is no need to do it then, and we don't believe that the convention requires that. And it was our desire through this work group, if possible, to all sort of agree on where a bright line might be, which seemed to meet the requirements of the convention and yet worked for law enforcement.
And again, just, you know, I wasn't part of those work.
Right.
Thank you.
Further discussions, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just briefly. I'm concerned about your analysis that this bill is an empty right, in that in Section 1 sub 2 that I read before, that the failure to provide information required by the section does not in itself constitute grounds for exclusion of evidence. It seems to me that's rejecting a per se rule. In other words, if you don't give the notification, all evidence is excluded. But it seems to me that the inference here is this is a factor that could be used in an exclusionary hearing. If that is true, why is this an empty right? I think it's the grant of a statutory right that will factor in the exclusionary rule process, particularly Miranda hearings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I suppose there's some potential for it being read that way, and I'm not certain what the intention was other than to clarify that if the Oregon courts would find that the Oregon Constitution requires suppression, this bill obviously couldn't prohibit that. And I think the idea was to simply say that we can't foresee that this won't be found to be a constitutional right, but in and of itself, it doesn't, by statute, create a grounds for suppression.
But you can hear defense counsel making my argument, can't you?
No, I can't.
Thank you.
It's a good one.
Anything further? Thank you. Finally, we're going to just have a brief statement from Karen Steele, who represents the consulate, the Mexican consulate here in Portland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Steele. I'm a consulting attorney for the Mexican consulate here in Portland, Oregon. Luis Elias, the Chancellor of Protection for the consulate, is present. I have been asked to just make a short statement to the committee this afternoon because of some unique circumstances that preclude our full participation in the hearing today. Several weeks ago, the Mexican government filed suit in the International Court of Justice against the United States of America, and there are proceedings currently pending in the International Court of Justice, and they have to do very specifically with Article 36 of the Vienna Convention. Because of the pending nature of that litigation, we will be able to provide the committee with further information, and I can assure the committee members that I'm taking down notes of questions that appear to be of interest to committee members, and we will address those particular points in some written testimony with Representative Williams' permission we will provide to the committee. However, we are unable to provide further information to the committee today. So with that said, if I might be excused, please.
You will be. Thank you, Ms. Steele. Okay. Is there anyone else here that wants to testify on 2047? Okay, hearing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2047. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2091 and ask Mr. Travis to come forward.
Good afternoon. I'm Timothy Travis. I'm the Court Improvement Manager for the State Court Administrator's Office. And those of you who know me will forgive me if I bask for just a moment in the glow of bringing something non-controversial to the committee after the storm of controversy that you just heard. Usually I'm right in the middle of those kind of things. I have given you, first let me say that the bill you have in front of you, I saw today the amendments for the first time, and they are inadequate. And so I'm going to be requesting that we have amendments drafted that that are an improvement over what you have in front of you. The materials I've handed out include a letter that I wrote on January 14th to Craig Prince, who's the counsel who had previously had this bill. This letter was a cover to a set of amendments that went down to legislative council. Those amendments were the consensus that was drafted by the work group that put this together. And the work group that put this together included Mickey Cerise from the Department of Human Services, Karen Steele, who is the counsel for Mexico, or the legal representative for the country of Mexico here, Professor Gil Carrasco from Gilbert Carrasco from Willamette University, Ingrid Swenson from the Oregon Criminal Lawyers Association, and Luis Elias, who is also works for the Mexican consul in Portland. And we got together around implementing Article 37B of the treaty, which is entirely different than Article 36, which you heard about earlier. The second page of my handout, the page that looks like this, is a copy of Article 37 of the treaty, and we are going to look at subsection B to Article 37. And what Article 37 says is that before a guardian can be appointed or a trustee can be appointed to represent a person lacking full capacity, that the consul of that person's nationality needs to be informed. And that arises in Oregon in three times. The first of these is a situation in probate court when you have someone who's going to be appointed as a guardian or conservator or a trustee for someone. The second situation involves a situation in which you have a person who is a stranger to a child who is attempting to get custody of the child, and the child is a foreign national. In other words, it's a psychological parent situation. If the child is a foreign national and someone else is suing for custody of that child, then the consul of that child's nationality needs to be informed. The third situation is when a child who is a foreign national is abused or neglected and becomes the object of what's usually called a juvenile court petition. Now, I want to be careful at this point to say that if a young person is taken into custody as a delinquent, this piece does not apply. 2047 applies in that case because a delinquency action is in the nature of a criminal action, and therefore notification under what will be 2047, whatever that's going to turn out to be, will be relevant to that situation. The amendments that we drafted is included in the materials that I've handed to you, the actual language is. You will see that there is a copy of House Bill 2091 upon which I had written notes. This is what went down to Legislative Council as amendments. But if you keep going at the end of 2091, there is some typewritten language, and that's the actual language that the work group decided on and agreed to, and that's the consensus of our work group. And when you see this again, it is my hope that you will see amendments that track this language exactly. Essentially, what it comes down to is this. If someone is going to go to court, they file a petition in probate court, they file a petition for custody of a foreign national child, or they file a petition in juvenile court, that person will serve a copy of that petition on the consul of that person's nationality. It's just that simple. All of these actions require that a petition be filed to start them. If you are petitioning and you know that the object of your action is a foreign national, you serve a copy of that petition on the consul of that country. So it just boils down to the petitioner serves the consul. So if there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Otherwise, I'll let you move on to other business.
Are there any questions of Mr. Travis? Tim, I apologize. I had to step out of the room for just a moment, but as I was stepping out, I thought I heard you say that you wanted redrafting on
yes.
the amendments. Is that right?
Yes, Chair Williams, I sure do.
Okay. Representative Ackerman.
I have one short question. I'm concerned about how one determines that a child is a foreign national. Would it not be a better requirement to plead that in the petition for guardianship, conservatorship, protective type of proceedings that the child is or is not, or on basis of information and belief is foreign national, that then would give all interested parties the notification of that requirement? So I'm very concerned about, in the pleading context and the court context, how we obtain that information.
The information is provided by the petitioner. I wouldn't have a problem with making that a necessary allegation in any of these actions. There is no duty to investigate to find out if someone is a foreign national before you file any of these actions. And the treaty doesn't even say that there's an obligation to investigate, either in this context or the criminal context. It's simply a matter of if you know, then you're required to serve.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Travis?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Mr. Travis, under either the bill as drafted or under your proposed amendments, and I may be here, but I just haven't seen it, what's the consequence of failure to notify the consulate where it's required in the statute? Invalidate the proceeding that one's pursuing?
The text of Article 37B states, "The giving of this information shall, however, be without prejudice to the operation of the laws and regulations of the receiving state concerning such appointments." There is case law in the abuse and neglect area in which people have come in to termination of parental rights actions and attempted to say that the state cannot proceed to terminate these parental rights because the Mexican consulate, in the one case I'm aware of, was not notified, and that theory has never prevailed.
Additional discussion? Questions? Okay, thank you. Yes, Council.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, you received a letter dated February 7th, from Mickey Cerise, Special Assistant, Oregon Department of Human Resources. And since the department is unable to support this bill, it did participate in the work group. And it talks about a fiscal impact of $2,100 per biennium. I've had discussions with Mr. Cerise, and I think one thing that needs to be brought up is the fact that even without this bill, we probably should be doing this anyways because the treaty applies. And what the bill does is basically flesh it out.
Right, and we understand that to the extent that it's not included in the governor's budget, that that's a basis upon which the department would have to indicate its inability to support the bill, although I would point out that with a $2,100 fiscal impact, it doesn't rise to the level which would require us to refer the bill to Ways and Means or to attach a subsequent referral. So to the extent we choose, when we get the new amendments back from legislative council to move the bill, it would be directly to the floor and not to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion? Okay, with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2091. Colleagues, we still have a couple of work sessions, and so we'll open a work session now on House Bill 2111. Council, are you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2111 was last before you on the 27th of January. It makes a decree.
Everybody doesn't have to leave. We've got some great support enforcement stuff up. Go ahead.
The fun begins.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have two sets of amendments before you to the bill. The bill makes a decree or order final judgment child support matter effective to the time the party is served with a motion rather than back the date for the motion itself. And you have the Dash 1 amendments, which are technical amendments, the technical fixes that come in from the Support Enforcement Division. Ronell Schenkel is here. Then you have the Dash 2 amendments, with both we have in gross versions, which come from Russ Lepesky. Ronell Schenkel is here, and both Ronell Schenkel and Mr. Lepesky are here, and probably be best to have them address their amendments.
Okay, why don't we go ahead, and I'll ask both Ronell and Russ if you'd come up. Why don't we go ahead and start with your amendment, Ronell, because I understand it's a narrower amendment, and then we'll go to yours, Russ.
Certainly. For the record, Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice. You should also have provided in your materials a memorandum on letterhead from the Department of Justice that lays out the concepts in the Dash 1 amendments. All of these were issues that came up at the public hearing, and we went away and worked with the partners to reach resolution. To walk you through them very briefly, there are adjustments to language in Section 1 as requested by the Judicial Department to clarify language related to the difference between filing and serving. And that goes along as a reminder with our new language in this bill about orders being effective, the date of service rather than date of motion. In several sections of the bill, we've also clarified language from comments from multiple partners regarding the service on the non-moving or non-requesting party, and there was some testimony at that once again at the public hearing. We have also added clarifying language in Section 4 at the request of Oregon Judicial Department to make it clear that administrative modifications of an underlying judicial order are not final judgments until they're reviewed and approved by the court. And then at the end of your memorandum, you will notice that there were a couple of comments made by partners that we did not address in the amendments before you today, the -1 amendments. One of them was a question at the time from Oregon Judicial Department, which I understand has been withdrawn, but the question was whether or not the judicial forum could have greater discretion in the effective date. And the answer from our legal counsel was no, based on the federal regulation language itself. And my understanding is that Judicial Department is comfortable with that response. And the other question was related to credits against child support arrearages in Section 4 that came in from the hearing officer panel. And that question is still being reviewed, but we do not believe mandates a statutory change. We believe it can be addressed elsewhere. So those were the amendments proposed by our department based on working with the partners. And the -2 amendments I will leave for Mr. Lepetsky to explain.
Hi, Russ. Go ahead and put yourself on the record for us.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. My name is Russ Lepetsky. I'm a family law attorney here in Salem. The -2 amendments are the amendments that were discussed at the public hearing in this matter. The short version is that in a situation where custody is changed from one parent to another pursuant to a court order, current law does not allow that credit be given to the parent receiving custody until there is an order that specifically terminates their prior support obligation. So, for example, if Ms. Shankle and I were to be divorced and I were to have custody of the child and custody were changed to her pursuant to a juvenile court order or some other order, unless there was an order specifically terminating her prior support obligation, that obligation continues, even if she has custody pursuant to a court order. So what the -2 amendments do is it allows a credit to be given against that support obligation for a period of time that the new custodial parent has custody of the child pursuant to a court order.
And I didn't even know you two were dating.
It's a deeply held secret.
Are there questions about either the -1s or the -2 amendments? Ms. Shankle, I understand that the department doesn't have an objection to the -2. Is that right?
Chair Williams, that is correct. I'm authorized to speak both on behalf of the Division of Child Support as well as the district attorneys who provide child support program services, and we are neutral on this amendment. We acknowledge, as you will see in our memorandum, that this is definitely a customer service issue that we hear about a great deal in the program. The only reason we are neutral is the unknown potential workload.
Okay. Are there any questions about either the -1s or the -2 amendments? Okay. Thank you both. We are in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I'll move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2111.
Representative Shetterly has moved the -1 amendments to House Bill 2111. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the -1s have been adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
The -2 amendments to House Bill 2111.
Representative Shetterly moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2111. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The -2s are adopted. So now we have amended 2111 with the -1s and the -2s before us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
House Bill 2111 as amended by the -1s and -2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2111 as amended by the -1 and -2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Go ahead and call the roll again.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Hummel.
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kozanski?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2111 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a volunteer carrier? Representative Barker. Glad to see you just digging in on this child support stuff. You're a good man. I'm confident that Ms. Schenkel and Mr. Lepetsky would be happy to assist you with your floor speech.
Maybe with visual aids, too.
All right. We will close the public hearing on, or the work session on 2111, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2113. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2113 comes to you at the request of the Attorney General Hardy Myers of the Department of Justice. It limits to a great extent the current law does of disclosure child support enforcement information, clarifies that the Support Enforcement Division is not prohibited from reporting child abuse by the provisions of this non-disclosure law, requires the Department of Human Resources to adopt rules consistent with federal regulations governing confidentiality of child support laws. We have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you, and Ms. Schenkel is here to address those amendments.
Ms. Schenkel.
For the record, Ronell Schenkel, Department of Justice. Once again, you have an amendment before you from our department, regarding the amendments. By way of being even more brief, I will just remind you that these proposed amendments were brought to you during the public hearing. This bill is primarily rewriting the statute related to child support program confidentiality. These amendments would simply take our federal parent locator service and also add that language into the statute with regard to access by partners and the public. And you will see in your amendment that we did make one additional change, and that there were several comments that came from partners that it was discovered in research existing law can already cover their issues, and so no further amendments were needed.
Are there questions of Ms. Schenkel of the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shero.
Just curious, Ronell, if you've seen Lane Barlow's letter to us of February 17.
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, I have not seen Mr. Barlow's letter to you. We had a conference call after the public hearings. We had a call actually last week with Mr. Barlow. It was a meeting. I was by phone. And most of Mr. Barlow's comments to us on this bill as well as our other bills were a difference in interpretation of the language. And our program and especially our legal counsel felt that the existing language gets us to the issues that he was having.
Why don't you take just a moment, Ronell, and look at this memo and we'll get your response.
Chair Williams, in response to a brief review of this memorandum, specifically looking at page 2, the subsection beginning on line 4 of page 2 of the bill, talks about the child support program comparing and sharing information with private and public entities. We did talk to Mr. Barlow about this and gave him examples, several examples, in fact. We are not troubled by this language and absolutely do not believe that it is going to provide an opening for other entities to get in and obtain child support information. This particular subsection 4 simply says that for the myriad of entities, both private and public, that the child support program does business with to exchange information about the families we serve, we can continue to do so with no violation of that exchange of information and no violation of our record. We do obtain information from private entities, and one of the examples that we gave Mr. Barlow is employers. We both provide them with information from our files when we're doing income withholdings, and in reverse, they provide us with information from their files under the new hire reporting statute. So that was one of the key examples that we provided.
Representative Sherlock.
Thank you for that, Ronell. And I think, too, I understand his concern, but I think also the language on line 5 restricts this to circumstances as necessary to perform your responsibilities under state and federal law. That seems to be to narrow the discretion, I guess, that you have in terms of sharing this information with both public and private. It must be in circumstances that are necessary for the purpose of carrying out your obligations.
Absolutely. Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, I would agree.
Are there any other questions? Okay, thank you, Ronell. We are in work session. That's a hint.
Right. Mr. Chair.
Representative Barker.
I move we send House Bill 2113 with -1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barker moves we adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 2113. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the motion to adopt the -1 amendments? Any objection? The -1s are adopted. Representative Barker. Now move.
Now we move to the floor with due pass.
The amended House Bill 2113 is amended by the -1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Andy, you want to call the roll?
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Trummel?
Aye.
Representative
Zagansky? Aye.
Representative Sedgley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2113 passes to the floor with a due pass as amended. Volunteers on that one? You want to go?
Sure.
Floyd? Okay, good. Representative Przanski will carry the bill. With that, colleagues, appreciate your attendance today, and we are adjourned.
Yeah. Sure.